Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me and obviously the fabulous Christopher, and we're going down an absolutely, I don't know if I can be any more excited about this kind of topic. Chris, why am I excited about this topic?
Well, this one does tick two of your boxes. No fallacies, though, so only two of the three. Today we have Gabriel Baker, who is a historian of the ancient world and specialises in atrocities. So those are your two boxes, ancient stuff and atrocities. His book, Spare No One, talked about mass violence in Roman warfare, and that's what he's here to talk to us today about. So, Gabriel, welcome to History Hack. How are you doing?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me. It's like negative 18 Celsius here in the Chicago area, so I'm glad to be inside talking on a podcast instead of outside.
Bloody hell. I thought we had it bad in Poland last week at minus 12. Minus 8, and in Chicago you got the wind as well, haven't you?
We do. That's what they name us after. So yeah. Windy City.
Yeah, I was there last year actually, and we were there and it wasn't even that cold, but it was the wind that made Chicago so much colder. So
yeah, that might have been the wind chill number I gave you. I just wanted it to sound very shocking.
You've got to sound shocking because we're going to be talking about some incredibly, incredibly shocking things. So when we do talk about things like genocide and atrocities, people tend to think of modern day occurrences. So for example, the Holocaust or Rwanda or what happened in Serbia and things like that. Occasionally, I think some people might even think back to pre-First World War. But apart from that, I don't think, or even at a push, though, I guess the Boer War at a push, really. But we don't tend to think of the ancient period to be anything like this. So we tend to think of the ancient period being very civilized and very, can you say couth? Is that the right way of saying it? I like the word uncouth, but they're very couth. And, you know, we've got Aristotle and mathematics and physics and all of these incredibly forward-thinking ways. But it's not really that kind of true, is it? I mean, how common are atrocities in this period?
Yeah, so to set the scene, my research focuses on the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE, and on the Roman Republic specifically. And this is like a period where Rome is transitioning from kind of a regional power in Italy to a Mediterranean superpower, right? So they're beginning to engage in increasingly large-scale conflicts with states like Carthage, with the Greek kingdoms and of like Macedon and the Eastern Mediterranean, with tribes in Gaul and Spain. And you know, they're getting really good at marshaling resources and fighting big battles and, you know, besieging and assaulting and capturing cities. You know, and they're doing this from Spain to North Africa to Asia Minor. And I think when we talk about the Roman army in this period, we tend to kind of get the shiny thing that we want to get distracted by is the big battles, right? The big titanic clashes, the epic sieges. And there's a reason for that, right? Like that stuff is interesting. And I get why we're drawn to it, but for virtually every war that the Romans fight in this period, for which we have any kind of detailed narrative description, there's descriptions of them sacking, burning, demolishing cities, enslaving and massacring prisoners, and sometimes even entire populations, and, you know, behaviors that we would unambiguously describe as atrocities. And there's some like interpretive problems with these ancient descriptions, which I'm sure we'll get to. But the general picture we get is that this stuff is happening quite a bit in Roman warfare, and as we'll say in other societies as well, and that the Greeks and Romans have a fairly permissive attitude towards violence and war, things that we would say like that's definitely an atrocity and transgressive. They might not necessarily share that view. And again, that's something we'll get to a bit more later, I think, but there's a more permissibility to this kind of behavior, almost expectation sometimes.
Would it be fair to say that they're quite a common occurrence?
Yes. So I have like a bit in my book where I kind of have an appendix where I just list off these as many as I could find of these events that are recorded in our sources, and I'm sure I missed some. But in like a several century period, from I think I have it from 400 BC to 100 BC, I counted 124 of these events happening for non-Roman warfare, and roughly the same period, a bit more than that. So looking at Greeks, Carthaginians, you know, Celtic people, it's just anybody else I could come up with in that same period. I think I have like 180 something that I found in the sources. Again, these kinds of events of massacre, mass violence, mass enslavement, city sacking, exceptionally common. So yeah, it's, I think what's worth stressing is that it's not unusual that the Romans have this attitude that like, hey, if you resist, like your city resisted and we captured you by force, so we have the right to do whatever we want to the survivors. And there are Greek authors in the Greek world who make similar claims. They talk about what's called the rights of the victor, right? So like you lost, that sucks for you, and we can do virtually whatever we have in our power to do because you lost, because in the Roman case, because we had to capture your community by force. And there, you know, there's some notions occasionally, some norms that maybe regulated this to some extent. And again, I want to get too ahead of myself, but we do see cases where the sources will react and say like, that was a bridge too far. This was transgressive. We see efforts to justify mass violence in war, but the general picture is anytime we have these more detailed military narratives, like this is there, this is part of them. And there's like ancient writers who essentially say, you know, like you don't even need to get into the details. When, if you mention that a city is captured, then the reader knows what that means. The reader knows what to expect. That means that there was, the city was sacked, people were killed. The population was subject to all sorts of assault and abuse. And so like, again, it's so common that we have some ancient writers saying like, oh, you don't even need to go into detail, like people expect it.
Is it kind of, I really want to mention Star, and I'm going to mention Star Wars. You have like the Tarkin doctrine where you blow up Alderaan with the Death Star, and that is your example to say rule through fear of force rather than force itself. We can blow up your planet, you belong to it, so everyone should drop in line. Is there sort of a Roman Tarkin-esque doctrine of this is what we've done to say Carthage, if you stand up to us, this is what's going to happen to you?
Yes, so we have to be, I don't want to be too pedantic. It's like, oh, you know, it depends on the situation, but there's all sorts of motives for why a Roman army might choose to sack a city or enslave its population. But one recurring one that we see is sort of deterrence, punishment. So if a city has fought too hard or rebelled or defected from a Roman side in a war, the Romans might then say like, you know, okay, you deserve some kind of exemplary punishment. One historian refers to this as conspicuous destruction. So you mentioned Tarkin and the Death Star, right? He's destroying Alderaan to send a message to all the other planets, right? All the other planets in the empire. Like when you mess with the empire, this is what happens. We do see that attitude appear in Roman sources. So like when they destroy Corinth, for example, there's some ancient authors who speculate on the motives for that. And they posit like, this is to deter other cities who might challenge Roman authority in the future. This is to say that like, if you are stupid enough to sort of challenge or offend the Romans, then you can expect this kind of severe treatment effectively. Yeah.
So randomly, while we've been talking, I decided to work out the average of atrocities over about 300 years, the span that we're looking at, right? Mm-hmm. So you're looking at half an atrocity, give or take, obviously, mm-hmm. a couple of points, per year.
Yeah, I mean, they're concentrated in certain pockets, right? So like we have certain wars, like the, for example, there's a war in the Greek East, the Third Macedonian War, where the Romans, at the beginning of the war, their commanders are acting with, I would say, exceptional levels of cruelty. They're virtually any city they're capturing, they're sacking it. There's examples of mass enslavement, massacres. Sometimes even cities that are allied to the Romans, they'll like go to them in this war and say like, hey, can you give us some grain? We need supplies for the army. And then the city's like, we're not sure we have enough. Can you give us some time to think about it? And then the Roman general just like attacks the city, sacks it, beheads the leaders, sells the survivors into slavery. And so we have these cases that, and this is all like in the year 171, we have like 4, 5, 6, you know, cities getting sacked by the Romans. So we have these examples where we have concentrated sort of pockets of activity, usually during intense moments of campaigning. So I think it's almost more useful to think of it as like, if we were to graph it out, it's like there are these sharp increases followed by, you know, relative lulls, and sort of, and it would have followed the path of Roman war making, right? Because this is kind of alongside the battle and the siege. This is one of the tools in their toolkit. This is one of the methods they use to achieve victory in their wars. I think it might be worth, if it's helpful, just sort of pausing and unpacking some of the kinds of atrocities, or what we mean when we say an atrocity in Roman warfare, if that seems useful. And so, like, I think we have to be pedantic and pause for 1 second and just say, what do we mean when we say an atrocity? What do we mean when we say like a non-combatant, for example? Because the problem we face with the ancient world is that it can be really hard to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants in war. So in these ancient societies, you know, an adult male's membership in a community often assumes military participation. It often assumes that their responsibilities and duties include, you know, fighting. So we get a sense in some of our sources that any adult male member of a community is effectively treated as a combatant or a latent combatant. And we further have lines between combatants and non-combatants getting blurred, because when war reaches a city, women, children, enslaved persons, they all participate in the defense. It's not just like, oh, hey, honey, we're getting attacked, I'm going to go home, good luck out there. You know, they're all participating. They're all fighting in the streets, you know, in defense of their homes in many of these cases. So that further blurs the line between combatant and non-combatant. And it's very clear that for ancient peoples, there's often not an effort to distinguish between what we would call civilians and armed combatants. Having said that, I think for our purposes, we can make a meaningful distinction between armed people actively defending themselves and unarmed people, or people who are not actively defending themselves. You know, the former being combatants, armed people fighting, the latter, unarmed people not actively defending themselves, we can treat as effectively non-combatants. So having made that obnoxious point, ancient sources describe all manner of atrocities against non-combatants in war, with some forms of mass violence appearing much more frequently than others. So first, there's city sacking. I've mentioned this several times without explaining what it is. And the Romans believed, as I said, that if a city resists and they have to force their way in, then they have every right to sack the place, to treat it as harshly as they want. And there's a Greek historian, Polybius, who is a witness of Roman warfare. And he describes this way that he says is the customary Roman way of sacking cities. And he says the moment they breach the walls, their commander gives a signal. And this signal basically is the commander ordering his men to kill everyone they encountered and to spare no one. This is a quote from Polybius: kill everyone you encounter, spare none. And he writes that when you would see a Roman city sacking, and he had seen this, you would see every living being, you know, near the breach killed. And he even says like animals are cut in half. And he posits, I think he's speculating when he says, but he thinks they do this, they must do this to cow the inhabitants into surrender. They're not literally massacring every single person in the city. It's just there's brief, sharp moment of indiscriminate violence. And then he says the commander gives another signal, probably by trumpet or something, and then they would stop killing and they would scatter to plunder, which they would also do somewhat systematically. And modern historians are kind of like, he's probably over schematizing this, right? The kill, stop killing, plunder. It's probably a little bit more of a free for all, but it does seem pretty clear. The Romans get in a city, there's this moment of extraordinary indiscriminate violence. And then they scatter, and they're basically acting on their own initiative then, without any sort of command authority. They are breaking into homes, ransacking places, committing acts of vandalism, arson, subjecting people to horrifying physical, sexual assault. And this could go on for hours, If it's a larger city, it could go on even longer, in rare cases, days. But, you know, this is just this kind of orgy of violence that happens when they would get inside a city and they would sack it. Also fairly common in our sources, we hear about mass enslavement. I've mentioned this already. Mass enslaving, often survivors, sometimes after first killing the military-aged men. And then we hear about various kinds of mass killing. This can be the kind of more hot-blooded massacres that I've just described, or in some cases, gathering up more or less selectively parts of the population and executing them, you know, en masse. And then the last thing is destroying cities. And this is a weirder one that I hope we'll talk about more, but our sources frequently describe the Romans. They're burning places, they're demolishing them. Either they say whole cities or select urban structures within cities. So these are kind of the main forms, you know, so the city sacking, mass enslavement, mass killing, destruction of cities that we see the most in our sources.
So when you say raise the city, in my head, I've got raise the city. I've got like complete and utter destruction of just flattening the whole place. But could they just do like the main civic buildings, like the points of power and things?
No, this is like the question that I think initially animated me to go down this path in grad school towards this project, a path which I often regret, by the way. So I remember reading these texts and being like, what the hell are they talking about? Like, what do you mean an army raised a city to the ground, right? So you get these images of like Dresden and Tokyo in 1945, right? With like the charred skeletons of buildings, you know, looming out of smoke and rubble. But we have to like remember, this is an ancient army. What do they have? They have handheld tools, they have fire, muscle power, that's it. So when our sources describe any of this mass violence, whether it's urban destruction or something else, we have to always have that sort of that predicate, right? It's like, this is happening with very basic technologies. So what's really happening? What are they actually talking about? And maybe the best way to, this is going to be a longer bit because so bear with me and feel free to interrupt, but I think maybe the best way to get to your question, Chris, like this process is to envision a Roman army capturing a city, dealing with survivors, and then destroying it as a process. So I've already kind of mentioned what happens when they sack a city. They get through the walls, they kill some people, they scatter, they rampage. That could go on for some time. At some point, though, the army is like, okay, we've had our fill of plunder, or the commander restores discipline, calls the troops back to the standards. But we know that they had to deal with survivors. You know, they don't literally, when they're sacking a city, kill everyone. And it's pretty clear in our sources that they have a couple ways that they might do this. We have cases where groups of a population maybe gathered together in like a marketplace or a key, or maybe a citadel or an acropolis, and they'll surrender all at once, right? So it's like, okay, we surrender. And the Romans will then come into control of a bunch of prisoners all at the same time. In other cases, we have a couple reports of commanders like sending out heralds, basically messengers, and announcing to the population, like, you need to gather at this location. We've captured your city. Gather in the marketplace, gather in this field outside the town. And we also just have these really harrowing suggestions that when they're sacking the place, soldiers are bursting into homes. You know, they're dragging people out of hiding places. You know, they're forcibly taking people. You know, there's like artwork that shows them grabbing people by the hair, you know, and just like pulling them all together and then collecting them in some kind of central location. So they've got all, at some point, they're gathering together all the prisoners. However they do it, right, they have to control them. So we hear references to chains, to collars, to restraints. So someone is potentially restraining some of these prisoners. We hear references in our sources to the Romans like sorting through them, separating the men from the women, maybe separating the, you know, quote unquote, desirable captives, maybe those who will fetch a better price from the rest. We hear references to the Romans sort of documenting the captives for sale. So this is a really involved process, like getting the captives together, keeping them under guard, sorting through them, maybe documenting them for sale. Sometimes they're herding them into sort of like ad hoc holding pens, like the walled precinct of temple districts, or into their own army camps. Like the Roman army camps are surrounded by a ditch and a palisade. So maybe they herd the prisoners into there, right? Just to get them under control. And all of this is horrific. You have to imagine that, like in the transatlantic slave trade, you know, the Romans are like slavers in that case, they are using violence, threat, intimidation, coercion, humiliation to break the spirits of these people and keep them in line. Now, once they've rounded people up, they aren't uniformly cruel. Sometimes they would release them. You know, sometimes it's useful to be merciful for the strategy of the Roman general, the reputation of the general. Sometimes they would ransom some of them, you know, if there's someone willing to pay the ransom price. But often we hear about them selling them into slavery. And what that means is there are merchants who often follow the Roman army around on campaign, and they might pass them off to these merchants who would then sell them into slave markets around the Mediterranean. And what I want to stress is that, like, even though when you're sold into slavery, you live, like, you know, your life in a way is getting spared. This is clearly, for some ancient people, a fate worse than death. So we have cases of people like saying, like, oh, you know, I'm about to fall into slavery at the hands of the Romans. I'm going to kill myself. Like, I'm going to commit suicide. And these really sort of harrowing, just horrific tales of there's like a poem actually describing the sack of Corinth that imagines a mother, you know, killing her own child and then hanging herself because she does not want to fall into slavery. And it's not hard to understand why. You know, you're being torn from your family. You're being torn from your community, your linguistic group often, your culture. You're being sold off to strangers who can treat you however the hell they want. So that there's real social death happening as you are torn from everything you know. And so it is an utterly horrific, terrible fate, even though they are, in a way, you know, big air quotes again, sparing these prisoners who are enslaved. Some prisoners also were killed. Not always. This seems to be a little less common, but we have cases of the Romans more or less selectively massacring or executing prisoners. And this can be more of like a hot-blooded thing where they would get kind of gather people together and then just set on them with swords. But we also hear of more kind of systematic executions. The Romans' preferred method, according to some sources, is beheading. And we have cases where they would tie prisoners to stakes, beat them with rods, and then behead them, often publicly. And so this seems to have been done in some kind of sequence. If it's a large number of captives, or you'd have kind of groups or individuals being led to executioners sequentially. This doesn't usually seem to be entire populations that are being killed in this way. So we shouldn't imagine like 10,000 people being executed. Often it's like the leaders of a city, maybe members of its elite, sometimes as the adult fighting age males. So again, a utterly horrific, terrible fate, all being done by hand, right? This is all being done by hand. So the last bit is the destruction, the physical destruction of cities. And while they're dealing with the captives, or perhaps, you know, after they've dealt with the captives, the Romans might destroy parts of the urban fabric. And they basically have two ways of doing this with ancient technology. It's burning, demolition. That's it. Demolish or burn. And the burning part is the kind of the mass arson part is fairly straightforward. You know, soldiers, maybe while they're sacking the city, can even do this kind of casually. So we'll hear about soldiers will like loot a house, then toss a torch onto the roof. If the roof is thatch, you know, it's going to light up pretty easily. We hear of a few cases where like they would peel the roof tiles off a roof and light the beams, you know, of the roof, the rafters. And then, you know, if you're lighting the roof, the building kind of collapses in on itself. So this is one way that they would burn things. And this could be done more systematically. Sometimes it seems kind of haphazard, but there are cases where they seem to be working together to like gather up flammable material to burn specific targeted structures. Like Chris, you mentioned civic structures. You might imagine temples, important symbols of a community. But it could also be done, again, more like a kind of mass vandalism. Demolition is a whole other thing. So if you're going to demolish a structure, it can't be done casually. You can't be like, oh, hey, we're sacking this city. We're looting this house. You guys want to get out your pickaxes and, you know, tear it down while we're at it? Like, this is hard. Like, you keep demolishing a building is hard. And it would have been something the soldiers probably would have to be coordinated for. You know, they'd have to be kind of ordered to do these things. They're not going to just do it on their own initiative. And they basically had two ways to do it. It's dismantle the structure with pickaxes, shovels, you know, pry bars, handheld tools. You could undermine, if it's like a fortification wall, you could undermine it, you know, using the methods of siege warfare so that it kind of falls in. Or you could, we have a few cases that suggest maybe you could use like a battering ram, you know, weapons from Siege Warfare to kind of knock structures down. And we have to point out that, you know, the Romans, this, and Chris, again, you kind of suggested this, but the Romans, they're not literally destroying every building, right? They're not wiping cities from the face of the earth. They're not destroying cities when they destroy cities. I realize that I'm using air quotes in an audio thing, quote unquote, destroying cities when they destroy cities. You know, these cities that are supposedly razed to the ground, like they'll show up again in our narrative sources, like not that long in the future as fully functioning communities. And it's like, wait a second, you said that city was destroyed. Like, how is it back in your text? Like 10 minutes later. So it's clear that they're not literally getting wiped out.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Out. And there's a tendency by modern scholars to say, yeah, these sources are, they're exaggerating. You know, ancient authors, they're exaggerating. You know, these are stereotypes about what happens in war. Like, they're not really destroying cities. And I don't think that's fair. This is like an area where I push back pretty hard, because I think we have to read between the lines and sort of take the ancients on their own terms. And just for the sake of comparison, my wife's hometown was hit by a tornado in 2011. Big tornado, mile wide. It goes right through the center of town, and it destroyed a huge part of the downtown area. And a lot of newspapers reported this as the town is destroyed. It's destroyed. And it wasn't literally wiped out, right? It's a swath of destruction, but most buildings are still standing. And nobody would say to the people in that community or to the newspapers, like, hey, you're exaggerating. You're lying. That town wasn't destroyed. We know what they mean. We know what they mean. So when my whole thing is that when ancient authors, when they say a city is destroyed, we have to know what they mean. And when they describe specific buildings being destroyed, when they go into more detail, which is rare, it's really clear that they're talking about specific structures. The fortification walls were partly torn down. The temples and some civic structures were burned. The place was ransacked. And, you know, it's partial destruction. It's not literally wiping out the city. But if your city suffers this, like if you're walking through the ruins the next day, if you're seeing bodies in the streets, your temple's on fire, you're going to say, yep, my city's, it's destroyed. They destroyed my city. And no one's going to be like, what a liar. You know, you're just exaggerating, you know? So I think we have to kind of know what they mean when they say that a city is destroyed. And of course they do exaggerate. And of course they do use sort of stock imagery. But they're leaning on a very real reality when they do so.
I've got this image like walking around the city going, nah, that's right. That'll buff out and put a bit of gaffer tape. That'll be right. That building's still right.
That's right. Just get your magic eraser and you'll clean it right up. That's right.
Yeah. All this wallowing, my city's been destroyed. That's not going to get this rebuilt. Come on, Nat.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like, it is also on that point worth stressing. Like, yeah, of course, these places could be rebuilt. And often lots of the population flees, right? So it survives. Sometimes people are ransomed, right? These places do recover, and sometimes really, really quickly, which I think speaks to, you know, people's strength and determination more than it means that they didn't suffer this real calamity.
We've mentioned quite a few sources, but what sort of stuff?
So the short answer is that we simultaneously have like a lot of evidence and a lot of problems with that evidence. And I've kind of indicated this with talking about things like exaggeration. So our textual sources, so ancient Greek and Roman authors who narrate these histories or describe these events, they will often not talk about things in great detail. And in fact, sometimes like there's one author who criticizes another author for going into too much detail, like it's crass or something. So they'll often be very curt. A city was just destroyed. A people were enslaved. You know what I mean? It's like they're not really digging down. The other end of the spectrum is we have some sources who we know kind of wallow in sort of stock imagery of like the destroyed city. You know, what typically in their mind happens when a city gets captured. And they're kind of drawing on, again, stereotypes and tropes of like what it looks like when a city is captured in war, when a city is destroyed, etc. Fortunately for the period that I study, we do have some good historians. I mentioned the Greek author Polybius earlier. Like, he witnessed Roman warfare several times. He tends to be fairly sober when he describes these things and careful about it. We have monuments from later periods of Roman history and from other cultures that show processes of, you know, gathering up prisoners, burning the roofs of buildings, demolishing things with pickaxes. And, you know, the artwork and the descriptions and text, they're often highly stylized. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're like worthless as sources, because we have to understand that a lot of these authors and their audiences, they have personal experience of war, or their audiences have personal experience of war. And that both lends credence to their accounts, but it also constrains their ability to just make things up. You know, there are certain expectations an audience has for what's plausible when they hear about a city being destroyed. So there, you can't just be like, oh, you know, they went in and they did something wild, like literally raise every single building. You know, when we get details, it tends to be more specific, more plausible, more believable. Another interesting source is archaeology, which I haven't talked about that much. But if you'll bear with me, I'll just give you two kind of quick examples that are kind of cool. One is Corinth. Corinth is a city that was fabulously beautiful, wealthy, ancient, a Greek city of a lot of fame and repute that the Romans destroyed in 146. And our literary sources, our texts, they are pretty clear. They say the Romans razed the city. They say the Romans killed or enslaved or scattered the population, and they end Corinth as a civic entity. And archaeologists have been working there for quite a long time, and they're looking, you know, for evidence, right, of this destruction. And they often aren't finding it. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that a later city, a later Roman colony, is built on top of the old city, and that kind of disturbs the archaeology quite a bit. But also, it's just the things they're finding are kind of ambiguous. You know, they're finding maybe some evidence that some important buildings were ransacked or burned, maybe some evidence that the walls were partly demolished. And it does seem like the population either abandons the city or significantly shrinks. But it doesn't match this sort of sense we have in the sources where, like, Cicero is a Roman author who says, like, oh my gosh, there's nothing left. It's just there's barely anything. And the archaeology just doesn't show that. So the archaeology kind of helps add that sort of complication to our texts. The second example that I want to give is a city called Valentia in Spain. This is a city that our sources say the Romans capture and destroy in 75 BC. So 75 BC, the Romans destroy this city, our sources say. But all they say, our main source says, the Romans, the word they use is delita. This is related to our word delete. So the Romans, they delete the city. It's gone. And so archaeologists excavating a small part of this ancient city, you know, they didn't necessarily expect to find anything. Maybe that ancient source is full of crap. Maybe destruction means something really limited. And what they found was in the forum, on the pavement, several prisoners, unarmed, hands tied up, who had been tortured and hacked to death, and publicly right there in the street. So much more gruesome, much more graphic than our textual sources ever would have suggested. And there's a Spanish archaeologist who says, like, archaeology shows that classical writers didn't sometimes don't exaggerate at all. They're often telling the truth, or they're even sort of underselling how violent this stuff is. So we have archaeology is a kind of interesting source that is the source that's increasingly showing us what these acts of violence looked like in really disturbing and graphic detail. So those are kind of our main pieces of evidence. We have the texts, some images and monuments and art, and then archaeological evidence as well.
So let's use another example of these atrocities. What happened with Galba and the Lusitanians?
Okay, so this is, I feel like I'm talking way too much, so I apologize. So this is a case that I could talk about for way too long. So I'll try to kind of be abbreviated because I think it is fascinating. But just to briefly set the scene, it's the 150s BC. The Romans have come to control a large swath of the Iberian Peninsula, the Spanish Peninsula. But much of the north and the west are unconquered. And this is leading up to sort of like one of the most famous sort of atrocities in the Roman world. And there's frequent friction between the Roman-controlled part of Spain and these sort of free, unconquered tribes to the north and west. And in the 150s, kind of the mid-150s, around 155, this group of people that the Romans call Lusitanians, who live kind of in the western part of the peninsula, they start launching raids into the Roman provinces. And year after year, the Romans march out to confront these raiders. And a lot of the times they just, you know, pardon me, they just get their ass kicked. Like they're just losing almost annually. And they do score a few victories, but they're performing quite badly. Because the Lusitanians are like pretty good warriors. Like they're pretty good fighters. They're quite able to stand up to the Romans on the battlefield, but they also show this real facility with things like ambushes, like feigned flight, trickery, hit and run attacks. Sometimes they're described as using guerrilla tactics, but that's kind of controversial and I don't want to digress too much, but they're quite good at fighting Roman armies. So it's not going great for the Romans. They're effectively losing control of parts of their Spanish territories. Every defeat undermines this image that the Romans are invincible and encourages more raiders to try their luck. So in 151, the Romans send a new commander, this guy named Sulpicius Galba. And he would have been under extraordinary pressure to achieve something in Spain, not just for the sake of like Roman security, Rome's reputation, Roman interests, but also because, like all Roman commanders in this period, he's a politician. And any military success he can win is going to help him in future electoral contests. So he's going here with all this kind of pressure to do something. And he gets to Spain and he hears, aha, the Lusitanians are raiding again. Now's my chance, right? So he gets his army together. He force marches them into battle, meets the Lusitanians on the field. And he does pretty good at first. His soldiers start pushing the Lusitanians back. That seems like they're fleeing. They start falling back. They start running away. And then his army kind of breaks into a chase. And they start chasing after the Lusitanian warriors. And it was all a trap. So Lusitanians are very good at this. They kind of pretend to run away. They rally their forces. They turn on the Romans who are chasing them, who are now all out of their formation. They're all broken up. And they just fall on them and scatter them. So Galba's army is completely routed. And he loses thousands of his soldiers. So he escapes, goes into winter quarters. He's probably super chastened. But he gets lucky because the Roman Senate, for one reason or another, extends his command. You know, try again, buddy. You'll do better next year. So the following year, he and this other general who's operating in Spain, they lead this two-pronged invasion of Lusitanian territory, and they just systematically ravage the landscapes. So you should imagine they're burning farms and villages, right? They're looting whatever they can find out in the fields, maybe killing livestock, things like this. And the Lusitanians, at least several Lusitanian communities, they give in, and they go to Galba and they say, hey, we're real sorry, we surrender unconditionally. Please stop. And Galba, according to our sources, he receives them kindly. And he's like, you know what? I get it. I get it, guys. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. you have real crappy land. You're real poor. And that's why you steal and raid and commit banditry against us awesome Romans. So, but it's like, I've got you, though. I'm going to give you guys territory in the Roman province on really fertile land. And I'm going to put each of your communities into three separate tracts of land in three separate locations, and you'll live a better life. And the Romans had resettled tribes in Spain before, so this isn't like a wild proposition. So the Lusitanians comply, and Galba sets an appointed date where he says, you're going to show up on this date in these three separate locations in three different groups. And all these Lusitanians, our sources say there are thousands, they pick up from their homes, they take their families, take their belongings, and they meet at these three separate locations on the appointed day. And Galba later claims that for some reason he decided the Lusitanians were planning a trick, and they were gonna actually break the truce and attack. This is what he claims later. Keep that in mind. This is more of a justification, perhaps. And so he says, "I'm gonna nip that thread in the bud," and he arranges this extraordinarily shocking and complicated atrocity. And basically, he goes to the first group of Lusitanians who'd gathered together on this piece of open land, and he says, "Hey, you know, it'd be super chill if you guys would put down your weapons." We'll call this an approximate paraphrase. And he says, "We're friends now, so what do you need weapons for, right?" And I imagine the Lusitanians are probably getting pretty nervous at this point, but they're like, "Okay, you know, nothing to be afraid of," and they hand over their weapons. And then the details are a little garbled, but what seems to have happened is Galba herds them into a pre-made Roman army camp, which is surrounded by a ditch and a palisade. So it's like a pen, basically, quite large. So he herds these men, women, and children in there. Maybe he's separating the men from the women and children as they go in. Maybe he's collecting their weapons as they enter the timber gates of the camp. Then once they're inside, he has his soldiers surround the entire camp, and then the rest go in with drawn swords, and they just butcher the men. Just, according to our sources, kill them to a man. The rest are sold. The survivors are sold after that. Then he goes to the second group, repeats the process. Then he goes to the third group, repeats the process. And this was extraordinary to the ancients too, because a lot of sources mention this as this sort of celebrated, is not the right word, but infamous event. And one source says maybe 8,000 were killed. Numbers are hard in ancient sources, but many thousands were killed and enslaved in a day by Galba. And he goes back to Rome. There's an epilogue here. I'll be brief. So, but he goes back to Rome, and you can imagine he's like, "Oh, I did good. I did good. Did a good job. Defeated that enemy." I'm kind of imagining he expected accolades for a job well done. And he gets back, and people were pissed. Like, there is real public outrage that he has violated Rome's good faith. He has gone out into the field. He's accepted these people's surrender, and then he has butchered them and sold them. And a couple of Roman political leaders, they actually propose a bill to the Roman voters to put Galba on trial in a special court. We don't know exactly what the punishment was, but it seems like it would have been pretty severe. And then they propose, either in the same bill or another bill, that they're going to seek out the enslaved Lusitanians, and they're going to free them, and they're going to restore them to their homes with as much of their property as they can get back. And this, Galba clearly hit a nerve. And what he did cross some kind of line, even from the Romans' permissive perspective, though he gets off. So he claims to their own people, "It was preemptive. They were going to attack me. I'm basically defending myself and my army." And he says, ultimately, like, he kind of puts on this whole show where he parades out his sons, and he's like, "Boo-hoo, if I get exiled, no one's going to take care of my kids. So I guess I bequeath them to the Roman people to take care of." So he kind of has this whole sob story, which is ironic given that he murdered a bunch of people. But he gets off in the end. He is ultimately not prosecuted.
Isn't that always the way, though, that you always have that sob story, even though you're the perpetrator? I mean, the countless times you see that through history, where somebody says, what about my family? Hold on a second. What about all the thousands of women and children that you murdered or under your orders were murdered? I don't quite understand this pattern of thinking, really.
Absolutely. And I think, there's two sort of pieces to this, like the reaction to Galba. On the one hand, it's like, it is, I think, good to recognize that, like, there is a portion of the Roman public that actually did believe that this was too much. Despite the way the Romans waged war, clearly there is an audience that is willing to hear that there is a point where violence becomes transgressive. And there are other cases of commanders getting in trouble, and not many, but a few where they get in trouble for committing atrocities. So some part of the Roman public and the Roman political class does acknowledge that there should be certain limits to what's permissible. Which is, I think, kind of surprising given the way the Romans often operate. But Galba crosses the line, I think, largely because he accepts the surrender and he offers protection to these people. And then betrays that trust, which doesn't help Rome's reputation. It's also worth noting that there's a leader in Spain who survives, supposedly survives the massacre. He's a Lusitanian guy called Viriathus, who uses Galba's bad faith as a rallying cry, and he successfully resists the Romans for like over a decade. And he, the way he gets support is he goes around and he says, don't trust the Romans, remember what Galba did. These people suck, and you cannot believe anything they say. And he is an extraordinarily gifted general, again, supposedly a survivor of this massacre. I guess there's a little bit of a comeuppance for the Romans at the end there, but Viriathus, of course, eventually it loses. And I think he's assassinated, and then his army loses a battle, but which is less exciting.
So are these sort of atrocities taken quite badly by the non-warrior part of Roman society? Are they sort of, as you said, this is putting us in a bad light, or are they sort of, apart from Galba, are they sort of generally quite accepting of it as, you know, this is just what we do?
That's a really good and important question. It's actually still, it's a question I'm still trying to work out. Because I think we have to keep two things in our mind. On the one hand, ancient warfare allows extraordinary license for victorious armies. You know, I've mentioned the Romans have this thing where it's like, hey, if you resist us, then all bets are off. You know, so like once you throw your gates closed and you start fighting, we can treat your community essentially however we want. And again, we see similar ideas in Greek warfare about the rights of the victor. And there's no notion of humanitarian conduct in war, really, not widespread in the ancient world. There's no notion that non-combatants have rights that should be respected. There's no effective international law that's going to restrain military conduct. But so we have to have that in our mind. But the other piece is that we do see ancient observers, ancient authors, historians, these notices about the public, like in the case of Galba, responding pretty negatively to certain acts of violence. There are moments where it seems to become transgressive. For example, when you accept surrender and then you kind of offer protection to people and then you betray that, as what happened with Galba. We see other cases where that is not taken well. There are some cases where ancient authors seem to say, like, if you take people into your power, right, you extend promises to them and then you turn on them and you kill them, then that is an atrocity, both as we would see it and as they seem to see it as well. So there are these moments, and I don't think it's consistent. You know, it's very muddy, but you do have these moments where you have a reaction. You have sources saying that wasn't okay, or trying really hard to justify an atrocity. Again, what we would call an atrocity, which suggests that they feel the need to justify it, that there are some lines. So I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind is, like, you know, we live in a world where there is a lot of effective, well, there is a lot of international law. There are really powerful norms against atrocities of various kinds. We have all sorts of non-combatant protections in international law, and we still see pretty constantly atrocities being committed in war. You know, like, just to give a more mundane example, like, there's a norm, a cultural and social norm against murder in most modern societies. People still get murdered. And I think we have to kind of keep in mind that the existence of norms side by side with acts of extraordinary violence in the ancient world, while it's kind of confusing, that might just be the reality, that there are people who say, like, yeah, this stuff is not okay. These are atrocities, and armies are still doing it. Side by side with that sort of rejection or that condemnation. So I don't know. I'm still working this out. I don't quite have an answer yet, because the general sense you get from the sources is that this stuff is very permissible. Most people just accept it. This is going to happen. But then you have like these pretty steady notices of, hey, this was condemned, or hey, the Roman public was pissed, or hey, the Roman Senate, condemned that general for massacring this community. So yeah, it's tricky. I don't have a single clear answer, and I hate to be that way, but maybe in a year I'll figure it out. This is the problem I'm working on right now.
But yeah, this has been quite an eye-opening thing. Like we said at the beginning, you have this idea of like Roman warfare as being somewhat more civilized, and especially in comparison to like the barbarians that follow, but they're possibly just as bad. But if you wouldn't mind minding everyone the title of your book and where they can get it.
Yeah, it's called Spare No One, Mass Violence in Roman Warfare. That Spare No One is that quote from Polybius that I mentioned earlier. And you can get it pretty much anywhere books are sold, you know, Amazon, the publisher Roman and Littlefield sells it as well. But yeah, please check it out.
And I'll, we'll see if we can get it on the History Hack website as well.
That would be awesome.
Bookshop as well. So yeah, then you get more money, we get money, and Jeff Bezos can't go and sack Rome or something.
But yeah, totally.
Every time
totally.
I do one of these, it's I'm worse.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.